Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Say Hello to My Little Friend, A Century of Scarface, by Nat Segaloff, narrated by Johnny Heller. Forward. Scarface and Me, by Stephen Bauer. All of us who made Scarface knew that we'd caught lightning in a bottle. What we didn't know was that it would take the public 10 years to open that bottle. Now, 40 years later, it's rewarding to know that we finally received that sense of gratification and acceptance and approval and respect for the things we fantasized about 40 years ago. If only we had known that at the time. When you shoot a film, you enter a separate world, the world of the film. But the world outside goes on, and while we were making Scarface, it was Al Pacino who kept me centered. It was my first big film. But Al was bringing 25 years of experience to the game and prepared me for what was to come. He was a sounding board who would tell me if I was off. He would not let me make a false move. We became a team. I taught Al how to be a Cuban, and he taught me how to be an actor. A month into the shooting, we had done 3/4 of our work together. I asked him in confidence, "Don't you have some expectations? Nobody's ever seen anything like this before." We knew there was no way the film was going to go unnoticed, but Al told me to be prepared because it might be more than 50% hating it. Sadly, he was right. It became the fashion to reject Scarface, to blame it for establishing a frightening new trend of violence in American movies. But then I remembered that Bonnie and Clyde got the same response 16 years earlier, so Scarface was in good company. Part of the audience that was first exposed to it had that response because of the subject matter. Al knew this. He said, "I told you not to read the reviews." When they came out, they were not good. I called him immediately. I couldn't wrap my head around it that the worst we thought could happen had happened. I had been looking forward to a happy ending, but Al said, "At least we know that what we did was great." I went into a zombie state for days. Yet I always had the feeling that maybe one day people would recognize our achievement. In hindsight, some funny things happened. I was called to a meeting by some young hotshot producers. They wanted me for their project. They started off saying, "We are such big fans." Then they said, "And you deserve credit because you're in that piece of shit movie." He said this to me while he was still shaking my hand. I wanted to say, "You've the balls to invite me here to insult what we did?" Needless to say, I didn't get the job, nor did I want it after that. Universal and the producer, Marty Bregman, stood behind the picture. It opened in December 1983, the day before my birthday, and it played in theaters through March 1984. But when it came out on home video and started appearing on cable TV, that's when things began to change. What we didn't expect was that it would happen in a bigger way than we could ever have imagined. It became iconic without the press declaring that it was iconic. People started hearing about it from each other, not from media sources. We started hearing voices of approval, not from the critics, but from people on the street. It hit me in waves, more and more every year. People went out of their way and crossed the street to tell me how much the film meant to them. By the late 1980s and early 1990s, the tide had turned. Instead of a slap in the face, I would get a pat on the back. When I would do signings, I would run into people who just wanted to meet me, to spend a few minutes with Manny. I tell them my stories, and they tell me theirs. It's an honor for us to meet each other. Scarface is now accepted as the important film we always knew it was. The good news that came from it is that whatever brought me to this place in my life, things are now better for me than they have been for the last 30 years. Better for me in terms of quality and joy. The fairy tale did happen, and those of us who are still around are able to enjoy this moment. Since appearing in Scarface in 1983, Stephen Bauer has amassed nearly 200 acting credits in feature films and on television. He's still active and lives in Miami, Florida, with his wife, Jennifer Brennan. Introduction. I'm proud of that film and what we did. I just finished a short, perfunctory television interview with Michelle Pfeiffer for the film Lady Hawk. Warner Brothers had flown the usual gaggle of movie critics and entertainment reporters to Los Angeles for a press junket ahead of the film's April 12, 1985 opening, and I was one of them. My Sierra Club engagement calendar says it was February 10, 1985. I didn't much care for the film, but protocol dictated that I'd keep that to myself until I ran my review. Besides, why would I let my opinion lose me an opportunity to interview a director whose work I otherwise admired, Richard Donner, and the stars Rutger Hauer and Michelle Pfeiffer, who were relatively new to American films? I was working for a TV station at the time, so I was given the usual 10 minutes per person to ask whatever questions I could squeeze in. Junket interviews are an assembly line designed to keep the questions superficial and drive the stars batty. Imagine having to give the same sound bites over and over again to the same vapid questions as if a director had called for 50 takes of a scene with a new co-star each time. As a cog in the press line, you do what you can to distinguish yourself. Compliment them on an early film, say hello from anyone you know in common, and so forth. My trick was to tell them to pull down their jacket and back so they don't look hunched over. This not only makes them trust you, it makes them wonder why their publicist hadn't told them first. With Donner, it was easy. He was as gripping and energetic as his films and garrulous beyond expectation. Great TV. I had been warned that Rutger Hauer could be testy, but not only had I seen his Dutch films, I knew his publicist and told him so, and we had a great 10 minutes of tape time. His jacket was fine. Michelle Pfeiffer posed a problem for me in those pre-IMDb days. I hadn't seen any of her episodic TV work, and the only 3 movies she had made prior to Lady Hawk were Grease 2, which nobody saw, Into the Night, and Scarface. I liked John Landis, who made Into the Night, in which Pfeiffer co-starred with Jeff Goldblum in a pursuit mystery most notable for countless playful cameo appearances by directors. Of course I'd seen Scarface, but my mission was Lady Hawk. She was bright and articulate, as well as heart-stoppingly beautiful, and we managed to keep the conversation flowing. The publicist called time, just as I mentioned Scarface, specifically why it caught such grief from the press. Pfeiffer immediately became defensive. "That wasn't fair," she said. "I'm proud of that film and the work we did." The crew had stopped tape by then, but I tried to assure her that I wasn't attacking Scarface, and that, to the contrary, I loved Brian De Palma. I thought Scarface was brilliant, and I agreed with her. I don't think she heard me, as the next interviewer arrived, and I was handed my video cassette as I left the room. Time, of course, has proven both of us right. Scarface is not only celebrated as the film it always was, but it has taken on additional meanings as each generation has discovered and appreciated it. Although it barely turned a profit from ticket sales on its original 1983 release, according to more recent 2020 figures, it has sold nearly 4 million DVD and Blu-ray discs, well outgrossing its theatrical revenue, and its popularity is still growing. Scarface is a phenomenon. It was about its time and yet was ahead of its time. And when the general public jumped on board 20 years later, the film was still relevant. This is because Scarface is not only about drugs. It's about two equally addictive and destructive substances, power and money. Brian De Palma, screenwriter Oliver Stone, and producers Martin Bregman, Peter Safier, and Louis A. Stroller knew this going in. They painted a Boschian canvas with their 1983 film that hangs in a cinematic gallery that has many other rooms and masterpieces addressing the same subjects, among them Citizen Kane, A Face in the Crowd, All the King's Men, and All the President's Men. This book is not just about how Scarface went from victim to victor. It's about Hollywood's long-running infatuation with power, money, and organized crime, both illegal and legal, and on the screen as well as within its guarded, secretive studio walls. This is less a chronicle about the making of Scarface, there are already a couple of those, than it is an exploration of its place in the history of Hollywood and America. Not just a 1983 remake, but its 1932 original. Each film was born of a time of social, economic, and political upheaval that only now, with the perspective of 90 years for one and 40 years for the other, can we begin to find clarity. It will become clear as you keep listening that I am a fan of Brian De Palma and Scarface, but I've tried to keep my feet on the ground. I liked both of them from the first time we met on screen. De Palma, with a double bill of greetings and hi, Mom, at the Central Square Cinemas in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and Scarface when I caught it, and it caught me, at a critic's screening in Boston. Alas, at the time I was only a stringer for my newspaper, so their lead critic got to write the review instead of me. I never read what he wrote, so I have no idea what he said, but I hope in the words that follow to add to his praise if he bestowed it, or conversely, to make up for any myopia on his part. Chapter 1. Get out of my way, Johnny, I'm gonna spit. In a very large sense, the story of Scarface begins not with the movies, but in real life. On January 17, 1920, for that was the day that the Volstead Act went into effect. Named after Minnesota Republican Congressman Andrew J. Volstead, a teetotaler who chaired the House Judiciary Committee, it empowered the government to enforce the 18th Amendment, better known as Prohibition. The 18th Amendment had been ratified by Congress on January 19, 1919, and the Volstead Act was passed by that same sober body on October 28th of that year. The Great Experiment, as Prohibition was also known, banned the manufacture, sale, or transportation of intoxicating liquors within, the importation thereof into, or the exportation thereof from the United States in all territories subject to the jurisdiction thereof for beverage purposes. Like most attempts at legislating morality, Prohibition was contentious. Even its passage was controversial. Congressman Volstead's Capitol Hill politicking had managed to wrangle a two-thirds majority vote to override President Woodrow Wilson's veto, and the partisan bitterness that grew out of the process lasted nearly as long as Prohibition itself. The 18th Amendment remained law until December 5, 1933, when it was revoked by the 21st Amendment. The intervening 14 years saw one of the worst crime waves in American history. Its effects compounded the widespread devastation of the Great Depression and the social schism of the Jazz Age. Not until the 1960s and 70s would so many otherwise moral people engage in willful yet risky violation of the law. Every major city had speakeasies, secret clubs where patrons could buy illegal or bootleg alcohol. The sources of illegal booze were broad. Some of it was from foreign distilleries and smuggled into the United States at great risk. Some of it was made in secret stills in America. Other hooch was fabricated from various dubious sources, including deadly wood grain methyl alcohol that first made you blind drunk, then made you blind. Just as it would become with marijuana, LSD, cocaine, heroin, and other controlled substances in the 1960s through the 1990s, having a reputable supplier who provided guaranteed quality was valued but expensive. And all of it was and is ultimately controlled by organized crime. It wasn't always this way. Unlike what is generally recognized today as organized crime, the syndicate, Cosa Nostra, the mob, the gangsters that appeared in America at the turn of the 19th century into the 20th century were mostly thugs and street hoodlums. The American Northeast, in particular, where the first cities sprouted just after the Revolutionary War, saw the formation of such groups. But it was not until the massive wave of immigration in the late 1800s and early 1900s that the modern concept of gangs appeared. Crime was not their first calling. They were chiefly ethnic and were protecting their neighborhoods from the arrival of the next wave of immigrants. The Jewish Lenox Avenue gang, the Dead Rabbits from Ireland, and their archrivals, the Bowery Boys, no, not those Bowery Boys, and gangs from Poland and Germany dominated the cities, especially New York. This changed in the 1920s when one quarter of New York City was Italian. And with this influx from the Mediterranean came the Black Hand and the Five Points Gang, the latter of which was led by Johnny Torrio and Paolo Antonio Vaccarelli, a.k.a. Paul Kelly. With Torrio's organizing of the Five Points Gang, the American Mafia arrived. It took a while for the movies to catch on to this source of rich story material. The traditional, simplistic, good-guy-bad-guy structure of literature and stage drama made the notion of a story with multiple villains seem foreign to audiences, especially unsophisticated Nickelodeon customers of early silent movies. Filmmakers, however, were eager to explore this new dramatic possibility. The first to do so was claimed by many scholars to be D.W. Griffith. His 1912 two-reel drama, The Musketeers of Pig Alley, is cited as the first gangster film. Earlier examples may be the one-reel The Moonshiners, 1904, unearthed by historian Tom Dirks. A desperate encounter between burglars and police, Edwin S. Porter and Wallace McCutcheon, 1905, and The Black Hand, Wallace McCutcheon, 1906, although precise release date documentation has been elusive. Because of Griffith's fame, The Musketeers of Pig Alley was given preference for preservation and has survived to represent that movie era's idea of street crime. Fittingly, it was shot in New York's Lower East Side, among real tenements and with actual gang members. The story was basic. Little Lady, Griffith star Lillian Gish, and her husband, Walter Miller, are threatened by a gang leader, Snapper Kid, Elmer Booth, after the husband's wallet is stolen, but they come to Snapper Kid's defense when another gangster threatens him. The 17-minute drama was written by Griffith and Anita Loos, and can create chills even today from Griffith's pioneering use of close-ups and the casting of some truly threatening-looking performers. Surprisingly, few gangster movies seem to have been made in the silent era. It was nearly 10 years before the next major gangster film appeared, Underworld, written by Ben Hecht and directed by Joseph von Sternberg, Jonas Sternberg, in 1927. The story of tough thief Bull Weed, George Bancroft, who comes to suspect that the man he saved from the gutter, Rolls-Royce Wenzel, Clive Owen, is after his woman friend Feathers McCoy, Evelyn Brent, was considered a failure by both its makers and its studio, Paramount, until the day it opened, when it took off thanks to reviews and word of mouth. Underworld was romantic but tough. Ben Hecht mined the stories and images he'd heard and covered as a Chicago journalist, and, in so doing, is said to have laid the groundwork for all successive gangster films and even film noir. Nightlit Streets, Deep Shadows, Drive-By Machine Gun Killings, Tough Dames and Anti-Heroes. Breaking the good-guy-bad-guy tradition struck Hecht as an epiphany. "An idea came to me," he wrote of creating Underworld. "The thing to do was to skip the heroes and heroines, to write a movie containing only villains and bawds." In doing so, he challenged accepted screen morality by giving his characters, all of whom were reprobates, a range of scruples. Audiences, he discovered, loved criminals. 5 years later, Hecht would write Scarface. The direct impetus for the 1932 Scarface was greater than a street gang strong-arm larceny or a romantic love triangle. The drought of prohibition and the public's relentless thirst created opportunities for those who were willing to quench it by breaking the law. Hollywood followed the headlines. Here were cops and robber stories based on real cops and real robbers, made more vivid by the arrival of talking pictures. The first wave of prohibition-inspired movie gangsters was the holy trinity of pre-code gangster films. The Public Enemy, Little Caesar, both 1931, and Scarface, 1932. Unlike what organized criminals would become in the future, the tarnished yet romanticized heroes of these films were strictly into running beer and booze, and incidentally rubbing out anybody who got in their way. They avoided prostitution, drugs, protection, and other forms of vice that the production code wouldn't allow on the screen. Warner Brothers in particular was lucky enough to have three actors under contract who bore remarkable resemblances to real gangsters. Stocky Edward G. Robinson was their Al Capone type. Humphrey Bogart, though not yet a star, was easily John Dillinger's double, and James Cagney became Capone's Irish nemesis, Dini O'Banion. Little Caesar, released January 1931, and The Public Enemy, released May 1931, primed the public for Scarface, released April 1932. Little Caesar, in which Edward G. Robinson snarled his way to the top of the mob, only to be killed by police, whining, "Mother of mercy, is this the end of Rico?" was brashly directed by Mervyn LeRoy from a book by W. R. Burnett, which was adapted by Francis Edward Farrago and Robert N. Lee, with uncredited contributions by Robert Lord and Warner Brothers' then-production chief, Derlev Zanuck. Zanuck was supposedly motivated to buy Burnett's book when a friend of his was killed by a bootlegger. Likewise, Burnett found his writing inspiration after seeing the aftermath of the St. Valentine's Day massacre in Chicago. Soon the scrappy Warner Brothers studio would become known for making timely movies torn from the morning's headlines. Little Caesar was one of the first and best. 4 months later, Warners released the even more galvanizing gangster film, William Wellman's The Public Enemy. Based on an unpublished novel by John Bright, it introduced James Cagney as Tom Powers, a homicidal killer who grows up around guns and vice and becomes a violent bootlegger until he is gunned down, admitting, "I ain't so tough." Bright, Kubik Glassman, and Harvey F. Thew adapted it for Edward Woods to star and Cagney to support him. On viewing the first rushes, however, Zanuck and Wellman saw that they couldn't take their eyes off Cagney, and the actors were told to switch roles. The Public Enemy was so electric and so offended Hollywood's chief censor, Will H. Hayes, that he boldly predicted the public would reject it. He was wrong. For all the fires that Little Caesar and The Public Enemy sparked at the box office, the rest of the industry was not eager to join the Warner Brothers gangster parade. Whodunits, cops and robbers, and detective yarns were one thing, but pre-code organized crime pictures were as rare as virtuous gun malls. What held the moguls back? The production code. Howard Hughes, who produced Scarface, among other controversial films, was not an ordinary mogul. For starters, his money didn't come from ticket sales. It came from an inherited tool corporation and real estate investments. Movies were for dallying and dabbling. He did the dallying with starlets, but the dabbling he reserved for picture-making. Unbeholden to any studio, United Artists merely distributed his independently financed product. He called his own shots, and in 1930 the shots came from Armitage Trail's novel, Scarface. The book was first published serially under the title Gun Girl in Underworld magazine, issues April through July 1929, and was reprinted as a standalone book, Scarface, on March 24, 1930, with the copyright belonging not to Trail, but to the publisher, E.J. Claude. Trail's novel is an unashamed romanticle about Al Capone. Its central character, Tony Guarino, later the 1932 film's Tony Camonte, is a Chicago slum kid who rejects his likely life of anonymity and kills his way to the top of a crime syndicate. For him, gangsters are his boyhood heroes, and cops are only there to bust you back to the gutter. Tony's first act is murdering crime boss Al Spingola, later the film's Luis Castillo, as the first step on a rise to having it all. At the end, he is shot by his brother, who has chosen a career in law enforcement. In actuality, one of Al Capone's brothers did become a policeman. Another, Frank Capone, was killed by the police. Unlike his power-driven creation, Trail himself was an enigma. Born Maurice R. Coons in Nebraska in 1902, he left school at age 16 to become a writer. Although Scarface is his claim to literary fame, he is believed to have written under so many other pen names that his full bibliography may never be known. Scarface came to Howard Hughes' attention right after its publication, and he paid Coons, Trail, $25,000 for the rights. This financed Trail's move to Los Angeles, and apparently set him off on a bender that lasted until his death of heart failure while at the Paramount Theater 2 years later, at age 28, on October 10, 1930, before the film was released. In those days, Hughes was not yet the bashful billionaire he became in his dotage, and was a well-known bachelor about Hollywood. He and director Howard Hawks met and discovered that they shared a fierce independence that would come to fuel their collaboration. "We couldn't get a studio, and they wouldn't loan us anybody," Hawks told historian Joseph McBride from McBride's 1982 monograph, Hawks on Hawks. "They just didn't want independent pictures made in Hollywood. So we rented a little cobwebbed studio and opened it up and made the picture." Hawks' recollections are as elliptical as his films. There was far more to it than that. For one thing, he needed a script, and the go-to man for Scarface was Ben Hecht, who had cracked the gangster genre with Underworld. Hecht was already working with Hughes on the screen adaptation of his play, co-written with Charles MacArthur, The Front Page, Lewis Milestone, 1931, but he was unsure about adapting another writer's work. Hecht's agent, Leland Haywood, took credit for selling Hughes the idea of hiring Hecht. "I went back to Hughes," Haywood told historian Max Wilk, "and told him I'd been able to persuade Hecht to do the script. I told him Ben's terms, $1,000 per day, and Howard didn't blink an eye. He nodded and said, 'Okay, it's a deal, but you tell Hecht I want a real tough shoot-'em-up script that'll knock the audience out of its seats, okay?' So Ben went to work," Haywood continued. "He was a hell of a fast writer, sometimes too fast. I didn't even know how fast he could go. At the end of the first day, I went back to Ben's house. There he was, typing away. I said, 'Ben, please slow down.' Over the next few days, I couldn't slow the guy down." Haywood was to collect an agent's 10% of the writer's fee, and if Hecht rapped early, the money would stop. According to Hayward's recollection, when he arrived at Hecht's home on the ninth day with Hughes's daily payment, Hecht was enjoying a highball and pointed to the manuscript. "Done." Hughes loved it and showed it to Hawks, who loved it too, which is one version of the story. A second version, which Hawks told McBride, is that it was his notion to pattern the script on the idea that the Borgias of Italy were living in present-day Chicago, and that Tony's policeman brother from Trail's novel would become his sister, and that Tony and his sister would be like Cesare and Lucrezia Borgia in an incestuous relationship. It was after hearing that tantalizing, if forbidden, key that Hecht came aboard, and the two men immediately started working on a script. Only it took 11 days, not 9, and it was a team effort. A third version is told by Hecht himself in his flashy memoir, A Child of the Century. In his version, his agent was Myron Selznick, not Leland Haywood, and Hecht told him he wanted $1,000 a day paid in cash by 6 p.m., in case Mr. Hughes didn't have any money. Hecht was a master of irony, particularly in hindsight, and he wrote the script alone. The published writing credits are no help in untangling the Gordian knot of who did what. If Hawks and Hecht wrote the script in 11 days, as both men have said, Hawks in McBride monograph and Hecht in his memoir, what were Seton I. Miller, John Lee Mahan, W. R. Burnett, who received screen credit, and Fred Pasley, who did not, doing? At some point after he'd finished, Hecht is vague, Hecht was in his hotel room when he had a midnight visit from two guys armed with the usual explosive hardware, as well as a copy of his 11-day wonder that had somehow come into their possession. As he recalled in A Child of the Century, "You the guy that wrote this?" I said I was. "We read it. I inquired how they had liked it. We want to ask you some questions." I invited them to go ahead. "Is this stuff about Al Capone?" "God, no," I said. "I don't even know Al. Never met him, huh?" I pointed out I had left Chicago just as Al was coming into prominence. I knew Jim Colosimo pretty well. I said. That's so. I also knew Mossy Enright and Pete Gentleman. That's so. Did you know Deanie? Deanie O'Banion? Sure. I used to ride around with him in his flivver. I also knew Barney. Which Barney? Barney Grogan, 18th Ward, I said. A pause. Okay, then. We'll tell Al the stuff you wrote is about them other guys. They started out and halted in the doorway, worried again. If this stuff isn't about Al Capone, why are you calling it Scarface? Everybody'll think it's him. That's the reason, I said. Al is one of the most famous and fascinating men of our time. If we call the movie Scarface, everybody will want to see it figuring it's about Al. That's part of the racket we call showmanship. My visitors pondered this, and then one of them finally said, I'll tell Al. A pause. Who's this fella Howard Hughes? He's got nothing to do with anything, I said, speaking truthfully at last. He's the sucker with the money. Okay, to hell with him. My visitors left. Hawks also had encounters with mobsters. As he told McBride, when word got around that he was making a film about Capone, he would get visits from people who said they were connected with the mob and wanted to offer information. Hawks would put them off long enough to contact a newspaper source in Chicago who would give him the skinny. He used the example of a man calling himself James White. So when he came in, Hawks continues, I would say, Hello, Puggy. How did you know my name? I'd say, I know all about you. He'd say, How do you know? And I'd say, Oh, I know. I know you started as a bouncer and became a pimp. You ran a saloon, you carried a gun for so-and-so, did such-and-such a murder. I'd get through it, and he'd say, I wasn't no pimp. And he told me quite a lot. Hawks also says he had an audience years later with Capone himself, who had obtained his own print of Scarface and enjoyed screening it. Between Hecht and Hawks, Scarface was infused with just enough authenticity to be real and just enough invention to be safe. Refused studio loanouts of established actors for their independent film, Hughes and Hawks sought new faces. Palmuni was acting on stage in New York where Hawks noticed him. He was not, as some have said, a new face. He had already been signed by the Fox Film Corporation as the star of The Valiant, 1929, for which he was nominated for Best Actor at the second Academy Awards. Scarface would be his third film, and he prepared to play Tony Camonte by assuming a hulking, ape-like stance, adding lifts to his shoes and adopting the mannerisms of a child finding joy in lawbreaking. A great many of the gangsters I met were pretty childish, said Hawks. George Raft, who spent his career playing gangsters, actually was one. He carried a gun for the gangs. Hawks said he met him at a prize fight and cast him as Guino Ronaldo, giving him the business of tossing a half dollar in the air, a trademark he kept for the rest of his career. Ann Dvorak was playing small roles at Metro, and Hawks was so impressed that he bought her contract for his own company, making her Tony's sister, Cheska. Boris Karloff's breakthrough in Frankenstein had yet to be released when Hawks put him in as Gaffney, whose bowling alley murder became one of the film's most memorable moments. Osgood Perkins, who had appeared as Walter Burns in the front page on Broadway, played Tony's mentor, the film's anxious Johnny Lovo. Karen Morley had languished at Fox until Hughes gave her the role of the vixen Poppy. The film's comedy relief was Vince Barnett, who made an off-screen career of being hired to play clumsy waiters at posh Hollywood dinner parties. His scenes were praised at the time but are cringingly puerile for a director with Hawks' expertise at comedy. It's a long road from script to screen, and Scarface hit many an obstacle along the way, most of them from the censors to whom Hughes had to repeatedly submit the material for Hayes' office approval. The first draft set the story in an unnamed city. Chicago is what appears in the final film, and features a state's attorney named Benson, who with one hand makes public speeches against the gangs, while the other hand is open to accepting payoffs from Johnny Lovo and Tony Camonte. Mrs. Camonte, Tony, and Cheska's apparently widowed mother, silently accepts her son's gifts of money that she knows full well is tainted, whereas in the finished film, she disapproves of her son's activities. And there is a tangential plot, noted by scholar Gerald Mast, in which Tony and Poppy throw a yacht party for Florida society doyens who revel in being close to a famous crime figure. The implication, Mast notes, is that organized crime could not exist without the complicity of powerful community leaders. On January 26, 1931, Colonel Jason Joy, director of studio relations for the Hayes office, he would later be hired by Fox in a counterpart capacity, noted in his resume, diary, that Ben Hecht had been signed to write Scarface. Following a March 7th meeting among Joy, Hawks, Hughes, and Fred Pasley, here spelled Parsley, who was Al Capone's biographer, Joy wrote to file, "Their story is startling, to say the least, but apparently deals with facts. We have not yet discussed to censorable difficulties choosing to wait until after the
sample complete. Ready to continue?